You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to a bank holiday special release of Mysteries and Monsters. 25 years ago today, audiences across the world were all eagerly awaiting the television premiere of footage that apparently would change the world overnight. That of a real-life alien autopsy. Of course, what we ended up seeing was a fake film promoted by the infamous Ray Santilli. One man was knee-deep in this with his position of one of Britain's leading ufologists, and that was Philip Mantle. Philip has been an integral part of British ufology for over 40 years, and he gives us an incredible and often hilarious breakdown of his involvement of that crazy summer of 1995 in the alien autopsy madness, from Jeff Wayne's allergic reaction to a bee sting, to royal bodyguards in San Marino, and his quest to get to the bottom of Santilli's alleged footage and where it actually came from. Philip has been a good friend to myself and the show since Mysteries and Monsters started, so his appearance has been a long time coming. We have a funny and interesting conversation, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. Don't forget, you can support us on Patreon by clicking the link in this week's show notes for additional content and exclusive early show releases. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube, and we are also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. All artwork, as usual, by my wonderful brother, Dean Bestel, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Right, let's offer a warm welcome to Philip Mantle to discuss his life in ufology and the infamous and frankly sometimes hilarious story of the alien autopsy. This week, I am delighted to finally welcome Philip Mantle to the show. Philip has been one of the leading lights in British ufology for over 40 years and has investigated more cases than I've had hot dinners. Philip has been a friend of the show since I started and helped myself get in touch with numerous people across the world. Philip, it's a long overdue welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir. Welcome.
Yeah, good evening, Paul. Nice to chat once again.
Absolutely, yes, because it's a year since I made your acquaintance at the conference. And as I touched on in the introduction, you've been very kind to me since I started the show and put me in touch with numerous authors and people. So you've been a big help. I'm sure that's nothing to do with us being fellow Yorkshiremen, but it always helps.
Well, you know, for those that are not aware, you know, we're the friendliest folk on earth, are we not, Paul?
Absolutely, absolutely. I concur with that opinion. So, Philip, a lot going on. As always, you are often the person that is usually quoted in the local and national press here in the UK when anything of a ufological nature appears. But also, we're coming up to an anniversary of something that still makes me chuckle, especially last year when everything seemed to explode again. And you've got yourself a revised edition of your alien autopsy investigation book, Philip. So do you want to just, and I know this might sound like I'm dragging you over hot coals, sir, but do you want to give everybody a breakdown about yourself and how you ended up getting knee-deep in this murky mess of a case?
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. I mean, as a young lad, you know, growing up in Yorkshire, my mum was from Northern Ireland. We always had books around the house. My mother was a great reader, Paul. But I was always interested in things such as the space program, a little bit of science fiction, and the paranormal. Even as a young man, I mean, I think was quite fortunate that my best friend at the time when I was at high school, his grandma lived literally right opposite us. Mm. And she used to attend a spiritualist church. Mm. So on occasion, I went with her and I found it fascinating. I didn't necessarily agree with their thoughts and beliefs, but neither did I think they were, you know, faking it. They genuinely believed in what they were saying and what was happening, and I found it fascinating. At some point, I can't remember ever remember the name of it, but I read a book on astronomy that had one chapter in it about UFOs, kind of dismissing it really, but there was a few pointers, you know, and that got me intrigued. So I managed to obtain a couple of books. I mean, the high school I went to, Paul, back in the 1970s was hopeless, yeah. You know. I can count the number of times I went in the library on one hand, you know, but we had a local library where we lived, and I used to go there, and I got a few UFO and paranormal books from them, and I was fascinated, you know. So I left high school in 1974, not really knowing what to do or where to go. I mean, I stumbled around from one job to another. And so late 1978 into 1979, I spent 4 months working in what was then West Germany. And just before that, I'd seen the movie Close Encounters. And whilst I was in Germany, because I couldn't speak the lingo, my mum sent me some books. They just happened to be pretty much all UFO books. I think she got them on the market somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
So I came back with more interest than I went out with. And then my aunt, my auntie Emily, lived just around the corner from us. And we lived at that point about 5 miles from Leeds, from the city of Leeds. And she brought me the local evening newspaper, which was the Yorkshire Evening Post, still going now.
Yeah.
And in it was a small ad for the first meeting of the Yorkshire UFO Society. And it was coming up that Sunday at a place called Centenary House, North Street in Leeds. So off I went. And as you know, on a Sunday in those days, everything was shut.
Yeah.
It was like a ghost town. But I managed to find the place, and in I went. And, of course, the Yorkshire UFO Society was set up by two brothers. That was Graham and Mark Birdsall.
Yes.
There was about 20 or 30 people there. Graham and Mark put on a presentation. I was just happy to see they had a table selling books so I could, you know, I could get some more books. And I joined. You know, they had a little membership, and I sat there for about, I don't know, Paul, maybe 6 months. The meetings were once a month, just kind of soaking it up. And that was me hooked. You know, I was in. And I was always one of those lads that, you know, wasn't satisfied with other people telling me what to do. Or, you know, for example, if there was a red button and somebody says, don't press it, I'm not sure I'd press it, but I'd want to know what would happen if I did press it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the same with the UFO subject. Rather naively, I thought, I'll join this group. I also joined Bufora at the time for a year, but they were pretty much London-based. And I thought, I'll write a few letters, read a few more books, and I'll find out everything I want. Very naive, I know, but that was my way of thinking. And, of course, I'm still writing those letters and still reading the books to this very day. And I think I was just fortunate, Paul, that I fell in with Mark and Graham at that time. And then as we moved into the early 1980s, for whatever reason, we had a lot of sightings come our way from all over, but areas in and around the market town of Skipton in the Yorkshire Dales.
Yes.
And we were very proactive because, of course, no internet those days. So we would make ourselves, how can I say, available, make ourselves known to authorities such as the police or your local reference library, your local newspaper, that kind of thing. So when people phoned these various people to report something, they could find us. And it was one of the things we always used to ask when somebody either wrote to us or telephoned us, was where they'd found our details, you know.
Yeah.
So we knew what was working. And we were inundated, Paul. So, it was the right time and the right place. And that's how it all started. As simple as that.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things as well, Philip, because as you touched on there, I think that the late 70s saw a big explosion, especially in the UK in regards to ufology, because because I think Close Encounters obviously was a massive success across the world. But we also, obviously, over here, had a couple of really notable sightings towards the end of the 70s and early 80s as well, which kind of propelled it a little bit. And it seemed that it's just one of those things, I think, that as television and entertainment grew and the appetite for subjects such as ufology and the paranormal developed, it just seems that I think it's one of those things that we were very fortunate to grow up at that time, Philip, where everything seemed to be happening and it was quite exciting and there was a lot going on.
Indeed. I mean, you know, the 70s were a hotbed across the world. Not was before the movie came out, before Close Encounters. For example, you've had a gentleman on here and I published his books, Calvin Parker. And Calvin's account took place in Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1973. And there was a huge wave of sightings in 1973 right across the United States, of which Calvin and his colleague Charles Hickson were but one. Mm. When I've been researching the various things I've written about, again, that the 70s seemed to be a hotbed here in the UK. As we just tip over into 1980, I know you've discussed it recently with David Clark, but two of the main sightings that still are discussed today took place in late 1980, which was Rendlesham in December, and of course Alan Godfrey's encounter in November.
Yeah,
they are still debated, hotly debated in some respects. What people tend to forget is when we move over into the 1980s, areas in and around Skipton, areas around a place called Carlton Moor. There's a little village just outside of Skipton called Carlton, and above it is moorland, and there's a few sheep. It's a lot of grouse shooting, you know, game birds in that area. Mm. Very few places of habitation. It's not in the middle of nowhere. It's just outside of Skipton, but it's quiet and it's remote in that respect. And for whatever reason, Paul, you know, the sightings used to emanate from these areas. What we did one year, I can't remember what year it was, but we literally parked our caravan. We bought a caravan, stuck it on the top of Carlton Moor at the side of the road in a little lay-by. Mm. And we put some signs up both sides of the moor pointing to the UFO Skywatch site. We did some local publicity and we encouraged people to come and report their sightings to us. And we stayed there the whole week. Mm. We had a lot of fun, Paul, I can assure you. You know, I'll give you one example. There was one lad who was a member of the group. He was called Paul Chaplow. Mm. And we left Paul in the caravan while myself, Mark and Graham went off. I think we went to Harrogate to do a lecture. Of course, we got back rather late and it was pitch black. And on the moor, it is. And Paul was in there and he got a TV. Of course, Paul had watched the horror film Salem's Lot. and he was glad to see us when we turned up that night. You know, he was absolutely petrified. So, you know, we had a fun time. What people did, though, because if you carry on over the moor, you're going to Lancashire, so we have people from both sides come and report sightings to us. And what we found out as a result, yes, there was an influx of sightings at that time, but they were there down the decades, Paul. You know, people came and said, well, I saw something 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The place is one of those places that is, and not only that, it's full of the paranormal. I mean, I remember Mark Birdsall and myself going to this other small village. They'd actually written to us, this gentleman. Mm. And so we made an appointment to go and see him. And when we got there, when I say village, it was like six houses. Yeah. And none of them had any numbers on them.
Yeah.
So we just knocked on the first door and they said, "Yeah, we're looking for Mr. So-and-so." And they said, "Have you come about the ghost dog?" You know, and of course they get told us about the ghost dog which roamed down the village. It was just two red lights. Yeah. And they were the eyes of the ghost dog, you know. Mm. So we found out other things that we weren't, you know, particularly looking for. Yeah. All in this one area. And it was fascinating.
There's something about the moors, obviously. I mean, you know, as a young lad, and obviously where I live now, just outside the Peak District, Philip, there just seems something very special about these kind of areas. I've recently just returned from a trip to a part of the UK I'm, to my shame, I'd never really visited before, which is the North Pennines, you know, Weardale and County Durham. And it's breathtaking up there. And there's just something about that isolation, because it's one of those things, I think, unless you know where these areas are, Philip, you just assume everything's towns and cities, you know. It's one of those places. As you touched on about Alan Godfrey's case there, I went, as you may have heard me and David Clark mention, we both seem to have gone on pilgrimages last year to visit Todmorden, because I just wanted to go, because I've always loved Alan's case. It's just one of those cases that stuck with me all my life as from being a lad hearing about it, and it was just something really important that I had to do. And it's very strange that when you get to these areas, you kind of feel as if you're walking in the footsteps of something very strange that occurred, Philip. And Todmorden's that kind of place, because
it is. And of course, you know, in the certain areas that are well known, there's the Longdendale Lights, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well known and been written about down the years, and I've been through Todmorden many times. I used to have a friend who lived in Burnley. Sadly, he's no longer with us. And there was a shorter route to where he used to live, but every now and again I would go through Todmorden just for the sake of it.
Yes.
You know, and I drove up Ferny Lee Road where Alan's encounter, and it's not changed hardly at all, you know. For those who are not aware of Alan's encounter, it was November 1980, and he was in the patrol car just finishing his night shift. So it was, you know, pushing 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
He'd been looking for some missing cows. And I believe he saw a fellow officer on foot patrol down in the town. And Alan thought, I'll take one last look and then it's me finished. So he's just driving up through Ferny Lee Road. He sees this light up ahead. And of course, when he gets closer, it's not a light. It's this, you know, like a spinning, the child's spinning top. It's got a bank of panels across the top and the bottom part's spinning, and it's literally blocking the road. He stops the patrol car, or a panda car, as they were called in those days.
Yeah.
And he tries to phone the, you know, get through on the radio to the police station, but he couldn't. So he took his notebook out and drew it. And then the next thing Alan remembers, he's several hundred yards beyond where this thing was sat, driving the patrol car. No recollection of what happened. He turned around. It had been raining that night. He says that the tarmac on the road where this thing had been was dry. Mm. And he reported the incident, you know. And I think he also made an official report. When he got back to the station, he was late. Couldn't understand it. His police boot was split. I believe he had a small mark on the instep of his foot, which wasn't there the night before.
Yeah.
Alan was plagued by this piece of missing time. Cutting a long story short, he was involved with a gentleman called Harry Harris, who was a Manchester solicitor, who hired two psychiatrists who put Alan under regressive hypnosis on three occasions, I believe.
Yeah.
At the end of each session, they made sure that Alan couldn't remember.
Yeah.
But what they did, they filmed it. And I'm one of only a few that's actually seen the video film.
Mm.
And, of course, they then invited Alan to view the film, so he knew what was going on. And it's it is a very peculiar film. And Alan, you know, you see him under hypnosis, and he says, there's a light. And he throws his arms up across his eyes.
Mm.
He talks about seeing these creatures. One's called Joseph.
Mm.
And it's a small human with a little white beard and a skull cap and a long gown. And then he kind of recoils a little bit and he goes, ugh. And they ask him what, and there's these other small creatures. And then he just says on the tape, and he looks very puzzled. This is, how did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
When they question him, what he's saying is he hears what they're saying to him in his head.
Yeah.
Doesn't see their lips move, and they tell him to get on a table, and he says, oh, I'm not getting on it. Then they say to him, what are you doing, Alan? He says, I'm getting on the table.
Mm-hmm.
When you speak to Alan, I don't think he would have been the type of officer you would have liked to have messed with.
Yes.
You know, no nonsense. He had, you know, commendations for his service. He said, look, Philip, you know, if I'd had a brick in my hand, I could have hit that thing and it would have gone clunk.
Yes.
As for the hypnosis, you know, you know, make of it what you will. But it is fascinating. And what I've done, I co-authored a book back in 1994 with my pal Carl Nagaitis.
Hmm.
And that was all about abductions and missing time episodes here in the UK. Hmm. So I've just republished it in a revised edition.
Hmm.
And although Alan's encounter was in the original, what I've done, I actually had an audio recording, not a video, an audio of the hypnosis. So I've transcribed the hypnosis.
Mm.
So you can read word for word what Alan actually said and what the hypnotist said to him. Mm. And it is absolutely fascinating. Been ill, unfortunately, so yes. I think his conference speaking days are over.
Mm.
You know, his story, you know, has remained the same.
Yeah,
fascinating stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, it is one of those things, because obviously there are some brief excerpts that have been shown on TV in regards to Alan's sessions, and they are extremely peculiar because there is a real sense of fear and bafflement when Alan's speaking during the hypnosis sessions, Philip, and it's a very compelling story. It's one of those. I know when I was talking to David, we were of the opinion that we don't understand why it's not more well known. Now, I don't know why that is, because I've seen it appear on several programs over the years. I remember it being shown on the 1990s TV show over here, Strange But True. I know Sean Ryder, bless him, did a very underrated UFO series, I think, for the History Channel about 8 years ago, and obviously went to visit Alan, ironically, with Travis Walton, which is kind of a meeting of great minds there in the world of alien abduction.
Well there's a story there for you, Paul, because your listeners might may be aware that they made a movie of Travis Walton's encounter called Fire in the Sky.
Mm.
But I'm not sure if you're aware that Alan's case was also in the melting pot for a movie.
Oh.
And it was that the producers came and spoke to Alan, and even made a little mini trailer.
Mm.
And it was a toss-up between Alan Godfrey and Travis Walton.
Wow, I never knew that.
Yeah, and Travis got the movie. Travis has got the movie because there was that much more to it,
yeah,
and more witnesses. You know, with Alan, it's just him on his own. There's no one else. So, yes, and I've seen the trailer that they made, and it's awful. but it wasn't meant to be anything other than that.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so he was in serious consideration for a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating case, and like you say, Alan is somebody I would love to have on, because I think it's one of those cases, but I appreciate that, you know, as you've touched on there, he's not been in the best of health, and he's still recovering, so we wish him continued improvement and hope he gets it through it all, for everybody's sake, because his story has always been very fascinating, and it's a brilliant book that he released a couple of years ago as well, which is extremely compelling, and I'm always interested to hear Alan when he's interviewed on other shows that he has been on. It is peculiar, Philip, because for me, it's one of the cases that really deserves to be more well known than I think it does. And I know for people like ourselves, we're very aware of it because we're interested in these kind of things. So, like I say, I mean, it was ironic when I went to Todmorden last year on my little trip. Whenever I go anywhere new, I tend to pop into the local charity shops just to see where I can find. And ironically, I found a couple of brilliant books. I found one of your Flying Disc Press books, which was Paul Stonehill's book about UFOs from Russia.
Right.
Which was amazing. Ironic that I went there and found this in a shop. And I also found a wonderful book about Tasmanian tigers. So it was even better for me, because I came back with about four different books that I wasn't expecting to find, as well as doing this little Alan Godfrey pilgrimage to have a walk around the area, Philip. So
well, here's another little thing for you. I actually ended up with Alan's police jacket that he wore that day.
Mm.
And it's now safe and sound at the Archives for UFO Research in Sweden.
Ah, fantastic.
So they have it. So, because I, you know, I have my own little collection of files and memorabilia, but, you know, I thought Alan's jacket needed to be looked after better than I could do. So the Archives for UFO Research at Norrköping in Sweden have his jacket that he was wearing that day during that encounter.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a marvellous case, but I think it would be remiss of me not to sort of dive into the one thing that seems to have dogged everybody in regards to ufology over the last quarter of a century, Philip.
Oh, no.
So as I touched on in the beginning, the alien autopsy. Here we are. I think we're about 2 weeks away from it, from the actual anniversary of the worldwide television event of the millennium, as it was was portrayed.
Yeah.
Amusingly enough, the other day, I was just before we spoke about you coming on, I'd actually seen the original Fox TV ones back on Amazon Prime. So they're clearly everybody's...
Yep. I'm on that.
Yeah. Everybody's planning to tie into this anniversary, like I said, because I think it was the 28th of August, and it's also coming up to the, as I was speaking with David Clark on our episode about Rendlesham, when you were the host of it showing at what was Sheffield Polytechnic and is now Sheffield Hallam University, where it was basically a massive media scrum, Philip, in regards to the infamous Santilli film.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, you know, but we go back to 1993, actually, Paul, when Rick Santilli wrote to Bufora. Now, at the time, amongst other things, I was their press officer, and his company, the Merlin Group, were looking to make a general UFO documentary. That's what the letter said. Mm. And, of course, it was passed to me. So I replied and sent him some info about the British UFO Research Association and... So we exchanged a couple of letters. This is before email and the internet. Mm. I spoke to him on the phone, and we were tossing ideas backwards and forwards. And then out of the blue, he changed tack completely. And he said, Philip, I have film. And he didn't say Roswell. Mm. He said, of the Roswell crash.
Right.
That's what he called it.
Mm.
And I said, oh, yeah, show me. Now, we mentioned Travis Walton. And Travis had a small part in this story, although he's totally unaware of it. When the movie Fire in the Sky came out in 1993, I was hired by the production company to help promote it.
Mm.
And one of the things we did is we put on a speaking engagement in London for Travis Walton and Mike Rogers.
Yeah.
So they came, did their talk, and I arranged a press conference afterwards. But at the same time, I'd been speaking to Ray Santilli, and his offices were quite near to where we were staging this event at the London Business School. And I invited him along. So he came along, you know, and I talked to him after Travis and Mike had left. And then he went on to tell me, you know, about meeting this mysterious cameraman out in America and buying this footage from him that shows the Roswell autopsy. So again, I said, well, just show me. Yes, I can. No, I can't. You know, this went on for so in the end, I said, look, I'll forget it.
Yeah.
You know, forget it. So we move forward in time to 1995, early 1995. And again, another item lands on my list. This time it was a movie called Roswell. It was a, you know, VHS cassette being sent for review.
Hmm.
And it had been made by Paul Davids, starred Kyle MacLachlan.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, I wonder if that Santilli chap still claims to have this Roswell film. Now, he'd give me his business card, which I kept in a file. Mm. So I took it out, phoned him, and he says, yes, Philip, but you don't believe me. I said, well, I can't believe you until you actually show me the damn thing.
Yep.
So he says, okay, make an appointment with my secretary and come on down. So my wife and I, we made the appointment. Off we went, not really knowing, you know, what we were letting ourselves in for. So we goes into Santilli's office. Now, Santilli's office was on Balcombe Street in Leeds.
Mm.
For any historians out there, Balcombe Street is famous for another event, which is the Balcombe Street Siege.
Yes.
Where the SAS stormed the Iranian embassy.
Yes, famously interrupted television to show it live here in the UK.
Well, that is Balcombe Street. So, you know, Ray's office was down there. It was a former place where somebody had lived. It was on three floors. You know, people were running up and down.
Mm.
And Ray, you know, was very nice. And he put this VHS cassette in the player and off it went. And he says, this is a piece of film that was shot on location in the desert. So they've got the creature, put it in a field tent before shipping it off to wherever.
Mm.
So you see this creature on a slab or whatever. It's under the blankets, but you see its head and its hands. There's two men in white coats beyond it. You can see their faces. They've got some kind of tissue in their hands and a knife. There's an old gas lamp hanging up. There's the camera's fixed. There's no sound. There's a man walks in front of the camera every now and again with his back to it. It lasts, I don't know, 8 or 10 minutes. To be honest, I thought, well, that's pretty much what I expected. You could see the big black eyes on this thing and what have you. And to my surprise, Santilli says, here's a copy for you. It gave me a copy of it. I still have it here today.
Mm.
So off we went home, so we could now confirm that at least some film existed. But he says there's more. We're having it, you know, put onto video as we speak. So we went back, you know, on a couple more occasions this time. And this is an important part of it as well, Paul. Mm. He actually showed us two different autopsy films.
Yeah.
It's the same creature, the same room, the same people. They carry out different medical procedures. The one that everyone has seen, the creature has a big hole in its leg and its wrist is damaged. Mm. The other one, the creature is completely intact. Mm. No damage to it whatsoever. Then he showed us some wreckage. The debris film, as it became to be known.
Yes.
So I said, you know, to Ray, what are your intentions? What are you going to do with this stuff? He said, well, I'm going to make my own documentary and I'm going to sell it in, you know, sell through, as it was in those days. You buy it in Woolworths or
yes.
Blockbuster or whoever. Or you can order it direct from me, mail order. Mm. So there was no television involved. Now, I was also Buford's conference organizer. Mm. And I had a conference already set up, everything booked at Hallam University, the Bronte Suite.
Yep.
For that August. And my main selling point was we'd invited two Russian scientists over from the Academy of Sciences in Moscow, the first and only Russian scientist ever to lecture on UFOs in Britain, then and now. And that was going to be the main selling point.
Yeah.
So I just thought to myself, this film, really, the only way we're going to find out anything is if this film gets into the public domain. So I just said to Ray, we show it at our conference. I didn't really expect him to say yes, but he did.
Mm.
And he said, on one condition, Philip. I said, what's that? He says, you helped me research it. So we shook hands. There was no contract. There was no money involved.
Yep.
He then went on to ask me to work on his documentary that he was still going to make,
yep.
Which I did. And I wrote it for him. I set up interviews. I set up Kodak to analyze the film. And he paid me to work on that. People have said, oh, Ray Santilli paid you a ton of money. No, he didn't. He paid me a small fee to work on that documentary.
Mm.
This was totally separate from anything else.
Yeah.
And so that was it, you know. And I informed colleagues, you know, what was happening. And then you've had him as an interview, and I've reminded him of this. David had forgotten. David Clark was at the time working for the Sheffield Star as a journalist.
Yes.
And he phoned me and he said, Philip, I'm doing an article about a young man here who started up in UFO research. Give me a quote for your conference. And nearer the time, I'll do a bigger piece for you. So I said, oh, great. You know, mm. Russian scientist, blah, blah, blah. Oh, this Roswell film. And that was it.
Mm.
So David wrote that up in the Sheffield Star. And then I got a phone call from White's press agency. And all they were interested in was this Roswell film. So yeah. I told them what I'd been told, and I thought, you know, nothing more of it. The next thing I know, the telephone's ringing off the hook. I woke up in the morning because I had a big old telephone that was also a fax machine. You know, Kim and the huge great things that you put on, you know. And there was faxes piling out of this thing from around the world. And they were all after the alien autopsy film. I had newspapers here in this country, you know, wafting their checkbooks at me.
Yeah.
And all I did was put them in touch with Ray Santilli. So it was at that point that things changed. That's when, you know, the TV and what have you became involved. Mm. And Ray himself organized a screening on May the 5th in 1995 at the London Museum. There was a variety of people invited. I played no part in it, although I was there. Mm. So there was a few UFO researchers, there was members of the media and others. I thought we're going to see all this stuff I'd seen. Mm. But the lights go down and he showed just one autopsy film. No announcement. Unbeknown to me, Ray and his colleague were in the booth at the back. They prepared an announcement and they're talking in the mic because they haven't turned the microphone on. So nobody could hear a thing. And of course, there was just a scrum afterwards. Santilli and his pal disappeared out the back door somewhere. I had no idea where they'd gone.
Mm.
And I was literally up against the wall with various microphones around me from TV and radio stations asking me the questions when they really should have been asking Santilli. But he had gone. He disappeared, you know. And then, of course, the press built up. We actually showed some stills of the film I can't remember what. I think it was May. We did it in San Marino. We did it at a UFO conference in the Republic of San Marino.
Right.
Santilli hired a chap called Chris Carey, and he came along with them. And believe it or not, and I chuckled as we were going into this theatre in San Marino, we actually had an armed escort. We had police officers with guns escort us into the... And then San Marino is a beautiful little place. It's within the realms of Italy, and it's just basically a mountain, and most of its prosperity is on tourism, you know, for people. It's a great place to look around. But they have a little bit of pomp and circumstance like we have here. They've got the soldiers all dressed up and what have you. So as we're going into this theater, there's two of these soldiers all dressed in the ceremonial gear at either side of the door. And as I'm walking in, one of them says, "Hello, Philip." It was one of the lads from the local UFO group who I'd met, you know, and he's dressed with his, you know, his metal hats on. He looked fabulous, you know. And then, of course, come August, we showed, you know, Santilli, to his credit, turned up.
Yeah.
We showed the alien autopsy film. The place was packed. We had to hire another room upstairs and show the whole conference on closed circuit television.
Mm-hmm.
We had film crews from around the world there, and I charged them all a small fee to come in. We even got sponsored that year by Sony Music, who were releasing a new version of Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds.
Yes.
And Jeff Wayne was going to be one of our speakers, but he got stung by a bee the day before, and he's allergic to bee stings that made him very ill. So we had a guy from Sony Music on the door, a lovely fella, and he's literally giving CDs away. And if anybody knows the War of the Worlds album, it's well known for its graphics on the cover.
Mm.
We had one of those upstairs at 20, 30, 20 25 feet, tall, Paul.
Yeah.
And we put a table in front of it and some chairs, so all the interviews were all done with that as a backdrop.
Wow.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I remember that the day before that, there was a lady rang me from Washington. "Can I have a ticket?" I said, "There aren't any." She said, "I'm coming anyway." So I said, "What's your name?" And she gave us a name. Now, my wife, Sue, was on the door.
Mm.
And what we had at the back of the theatre was just a couple of chairs.
Yeah.
And we had some guides to show people where to go and what have you. And lo and behold, this lady turned up. You know, so didn't charge her anything. I just got one of our volunteers to stand up. I let her sit down, and she was over the moon. And not only that, we had a Chinese... TV crew. We got up with television crews from around the world, but the Chinese turned up again unannounced.
Mm.
And I said, "Look, I've charged all the other TV companies a small fee to come in, and they can film whatever they like." "Oh, we've not got any money. We're from China. We're poor." I said, "Well, sorry, but you can't come in." So they scuttled across outside and went to the cash point, got the money in cash, and come back and gave it to me. So that night we were in the bar at the hotel, and I just said to the guy behind the bar, I still had the cash in my inside jacket pocket.
Yeah.
I just said, "Here, put that behind the bar, and it's drinks for all the, for, you know," because there was the, you know, again, our volunteers were there, our stewards, we were all having a drink. I said, "You know, pay for their drink until it runs out." But the funniest thing of all, before Santilli showed the film, he brought in his own security.
Mm.
So the theatre was empty, and everybody was searched as they come in, looking for cameras and what have you, because it was going out on television the next day, literally, around the world, and he got millions riding on it.
Yeah.
So nobody had a camera or anything like that. We showed it. Everything went off. The guy came down from the projection booth, handed Ray Santilli the video cassette, and we were all chatting away. You know, and Ray put the cassette down on the table, And we're chatting away, turned around, and the cassette had gone. It disappeared. And he said, you know, the look on his face, he said, that's it. It, you know, the deals are off. And then one of the lads came out from behind and said, here you go.
Oh, dear. You know, I bet he was having palpitations there, Philip.
Not half. You should have seen the look on his face. And it was his own fault. He'd been given it in his hand as he requested. He put it down. Mm-hmm. And nobody saw anybody pick it up, you know. And that, you know, and the story went out. It was shown on Alien Autopsy Fact or Fiction in the States. That was so popular, Paul, that the producer, Bob Kiwiak, was ordered to do two extras. He had to do two follow-up specials, you know. And I think it was Fox's, when it came out on video that year, it was the biggest selling, you know, documentary video of its time.
Yeah.
You can still watch it now on Netflix, I believe.
Yes, yeah, it's definitely there. I was saying, obviously I caught it because it was quite interesting because one of the strange things about all this, one of these, there's lots of little weird things about it and people involved that you would never expect. And obviously the American programs were all hosted by Jonathan Frakes, who is obviously most famous for being Star Trek The Next Generation, who seemed to be the face of ufology. Whether that was because he had a real interest in the subject, Philip, or because he simply worked, he was part of the cast of Star Trek, I'm not sure.
Bit of both, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and Star Trek had finished at that time, so as an actor, he was in between jobs, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, it was the first UFO battle online. You know, the internet was now born, and, you know,
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
Was CompuSue? There was no Google or anything like that.
Yeah.
But people were still arguing, and of course the accusations came. My wife and I were at the time, for example, were having an extension built on our house. Mm. We'd had children, so we either had to move or stay where we are and expand the house. Mm. People were saying, "Well, where does Mantle get his money from? He must be getting it from Ray Santilli. Mm. He hasn't got that kind of money." Well, they were right. I didn't have that kind of money, but my wife did. You know, she'd had her own property before we met, you know, which had been rented out. We sold it, and we used some of the money from that to build the extension on our house. A simple thing. Yeah. I was also accused of being Ray Santilli's accomplice by one halfwit. And, you know, and lots more besides, you know.
Absolutely.
And I sat with Santilli one afternoon, and we had lunch together in London, and I said, "I'll get to the bottom of it, Ray, no matter what." And he said, "It's fine, Philip." And he just smiled and carried on. Mm. So because it became so personal and the accusations to me were personal, I stuck at it. I, you know, I suspected that once it was out on television, Paul, that the answers would start to appear.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Crime Watch. Have you seen this fellow? We've got a film of him.
Yes.
You know? And I thought somebody will step forward and say, "That's me, I'm one of the actors," or "It was filmed at my studio," or whatever. Or someone might step forward and say, "Well, my granddad told me about this."
Yeah.
You know, 20 years ago. Mm. But absolutely nothing. I mean, nothing of any substance whatsoever. Mm. But we have to remember, you know, not all of the film had been shown. We still had this tent footage, which Santilli had mysteriously disowned.
Yep.
We still had the other autopsy film that hadn't been shown. And then later on, lo and behold, Santilli produced an interview with the mysterious cameraman.
Yes.
You know? So in total, there are five separate films. There's the debris film.
Yep.
There's two autopsies. There's the tent footage. Mm. And there's the cameraman's interview. So when you talk about the alien autopsy film, it's not one film. It is five separate pieces of film. And, of course, you know, Santilli's promises to deliver pieces to be analysed at Kodak, you know, never materialised. I lined up Kodak and Hemel Hempstead here in the UK, spoke to them, They were more than happy. They wouldn't comment on what the film showed,
yeah,
but they would analyse it for its age. They even brought in the British Film Institute, who were specialists in handling old film. And Santilli, believe it or not, didn't live that far from Kodak. He could have hand-delivered it,
yeah,
you know? But, of course, it never happened. It never happened. And, of course, you know, he made a lot of money out of it. So we'd chip away and chip away and chip away at it. You know, I worked with colleagues in different parts of the world trying to figure out, you know, what had happened. And then, of course, the first thing to bite the dust was the tent footage, the very first piece of film he showed us. I had an email from a chap called Keith, and he said, I know something about the alien autopsy film. Right, what do you know? I know I made it. Give me your phone number. Here it is. So I phoned Keith,
yep,
and he told me the story. He said, I work in animation. And I went to this company in Milton Keynes to try and get some work. You know, I'm a freelancer.
Yeah.
And he says, the place is called, was called AK Music. A and K standing for Andy and Keith. He said, I'm in their office, and the phone goes. There's another Keith who owns this company. He's called Keith Bateman. And I said, I could hear him on the telephone, and he's speaking to Ray Santilli. Now, he said, I'd seen the alien autopsy film. So when he came off the phone, I said to him, is that Ray Santilli, the alien autopsy man? He says, yeah. He says, oh, you know, I've seen the documentary. He says, oh, he says, we made it. So he says, you what? So he gave me the details. Now, AK Music had closed, but I got their details from Company House. Mm. And, of course, he gave me the address of the people that owned it, which was Andy Price-Watts and Keith Bateman. Now, Andy was ill, but I wrote to Keith and eventually spoke to him, and they hadn't made what we know as the alien autopsy. Keith had made the tent footage.
Mm.
And when you speak to Keith, and I met him in person, and his colleagues that worked with him, he said, what happened was, he says, we used to have a working relationship with Santilli, and we'd meet up every now and again, and have, like, silly, stupid brainstorming sessions, you know what I mean? Daft stuff. And he said, we're all chatting away one day, and then Santilli pipes up and says, wouldn't it be great if we had some Roswell footage? And he says, just by chance, one of the chaps that worked for him is a chap called Philip Yarman.
Mm.
Philip had a UFO book, and in it was three or four pages about Roswell. So Santilli went off. Keith had a light bulb moment, went to a farm in Bedfordshire, and he made the tent footage. The two guys you see chopping this thing up, one of his colleagues who worked for him, the other is a local butcher. You know, so the giblets you see them handling is real. It's real flesh.
Yeah.
The man that walks in front of the camera from every now and again is actually the farmer. And underneath the sheet is Keith's, I think it was 10-year-old son. Because you could see the outline of a body, but the head of the alien was actually a polystyrene head that you put wigs on. And Keith had just put some orange peel and made the eyes bigger, and just got a pen and made them black. And that is the tent footage. So he takes this, you know, they run it through the computer, they, you know, put scratches on it, made it a bit darker and so on. They gave it to Santilli. They showed Santilli, and Santilli said, it's not good enough. I need a budget for something really clear. So Keith went off and got a budget and came back, and Santilli says, no, that's too much. But, you know, the fuse had been lit.
Yeah.
And Santilli kept hold of that tent footage, and it was that he used as bait. So we move forward in time to 1995. Now, everybody knows about the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
But Cannes also hosts a TV festival every year.
Mm-hmm.
And Santilli was one of those that used to go to it. Another gentleman stepped forward, and he's, I think you've spoken to him, he's Spiros Malaris.
Yes.
Now, Spiros used to run his own little film crew. He was going out to Cannes, but he had some spare time on his hands. So what he did, he took out a trade directory and he picked out some companies that were close to where his offices were, and he sent them a fax. One of them just happened to be Santilli's. He met Santilli out in Cannes. Santilli told him this strange story about this Roswell footage and paying a lot of money for this film and this strange cameraman. So when he came back to London, Spiros went to his to Ray's offices. He showed him the tent footage, and Spiros says, that's never seen film. And when I say film, I mean celluloid.
Yeah.
He says, that's been shot on video. I can tell. Santa Lee, oh, well, I paid a lot of money for this film. Oh. You know, well, he hadn't. See, he was made by Keith Bateman.
Yeah.
So Spiros is driving off home. Just so happens that his best friend at the time was a sculptor.
Yeah.
Academy-trained sculptor, Royal Academy, called John Humphreys. He rings John up and said, how about this for an idea? Alien autopsy. Went back to Santilli, said, we can make you one. This is what it'll cost you. And it went from there. And Spiros, John Humphreys, one or two others, made the alien autopsy film. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that there's two is because when Spiros and his colleagues made the first one, upon review, they'd made a mistake with the medical procedure. It was Spiros's girlfriend at the time who'd done the research into the medical side of things.
Mm.
And she said, if you release that, it will instantly be known to be a hoax, because they don't do that.
Yeah.
So they'd run out of money. So Spiros says, don't worry about it. I'll pay for another one to be made out of my own pocket. So they still got the mold. So they reset it, come back tomorrow. Lo and behold, when they got back, I mean, the set was made in Spiros's sister's apartment.
Yeah.
Because she was having it, I'll say, decorated, for want of a better word, but she was having it upgraded.
Yes.
And they'd actually had a burglary. And he says, can you imagine the look on the face of the burglar when he opened the living room door and you see the alien, because they just left it where it was. There's the alien lying on the slab with its guts cut out and its brains hanging out, you know.
One way to deter him, Philip.
Yeah. So anyway, they take the second alien out of the mold, and it's got a fault. It's got a big hole in its leg. There's been an air pocket.
Mm.
So they improvise. They go to the butcher. They get a bone and some stuff. Stick that in, you know, and burn it to make it look like it's an injury. Yeah. And they off they go. They film it again, and that's the one that everybody has seen on television. But there are two different autopsy films. Yeah. Now, the difference with Spiros and Ray Santilli, Spiros says, we never made it to hoax anyone for any money.
Yeah.
He said, our idea was we'd show it, we'd let it out, and then, you know, 6 or 9 months later, we'd do the reveal, you know, da-da, we made it, in the hope that him as a filmmaker, and a magician, by the way, he's also a magician, would get some more work, and that his friend John Humphreys, who he says is one of the most talented people you could ever wish to meet, but is not a businessman, will get more work as a result.
Yeah.
But Santilli kept coming back with this sob story saying, no, I've not made my money back on it yet. And so they just left it. You know, they were not interested in UFOs or anything. You know, they were still friends with Santilli for a while, and off they went. And of course, the rest, of course, is history. Santilli released it and sold it as being genuine.
Yes.
So, the tent footage had bit the dust, so it moved forward in time. And then I was actually working for a small publisher at this point in Leeds. My boss, Heather, knew of my involvement. I mean, we're going to be publishing some UFO books. But she knew of my interest and my involvement in the alien autopsy saga. And out of the blue, she said to us one day, I've got my boyfriend coming for lunch. Now, we'd never seen her with a fella.
Mm.
So anyway, this smart-looking gentleman turned up, you know, with his briefcase, and he'd actually come up from London. And we were on the outskirts of Leeds, and he was a nice guy. I can't remember his name without looking through my files.
Mm.
So we had lunch, and we're chatting away, and comes to the subject of the alien autopsy, and he said, I asked him, I said, what do you do for a living? He said, well, I'm actually a trained barrister, but I don't practice in court. I do contract law.
Mm.
So, and you'll never believe this. He opens his briefcase, and what's in his briefcase? But is the contract for Ray Santilli and Gary Shewfield to make the movie Alien Autopsy, starring Ant and Dec. He's in his briefcase. Santilli had come and brought him the contract for him to look over.
Oh, my God.
And he let me read it. You know, I'm sure it wasn't, you know, strictly ethical, but he let me read it. So we then got to know that they were making a movie, you know, which went on to be released by Warner Brothers, starred, you know, everybody's TV favourites, Ant and Dec.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, armed with this information, I went to London and I met, this was the last time I met him, was Ray Santilli and Gary Shewfield. We went for lunch, Yep. And we're sat in this, near Ray's office. There's like it was there. I don't know if it's still there. But it was almost like one of these old-fashioned gentlemen's clubs, you know? And we sat there having a drink. I'd gone down on the train. You know, Ray's his charming self. Gary Shoofield I never liked. We're as obnoxious as ever. And I said, I know you're making a movie. Oh, yeah. And I said, and how much are you getting paid for it? Oh, yeah. And I told them. And you should have seen the look on their faces. Paul, it was unbelievable because I was absolutely spot on. I wasn't close. I was bang on.
Mm.
And they said, what else do you know? I said, and then I lied.
Yeah.
I said, I know a lot more about you two guys and what you've been up to.
Yeah.
You know? And they were astonished, absolutely astonished. So I got in touch with the production company. And I was speaking via email to one of their executives, a lady. Hmm. And I said, I know you can't tell me anything about the movie, so I'm not going to ask any questions. And we just talked generally. And I said, I want to ask you one question. And if you can't tell me, it's fine. I said, who's doing your special effects for you? She says, it's John Humphreys. He made the dummies for us, and he made them for Ray Santilli as well. You know, so there you go.
Yeah. You know? One of the things that's always perplexed me about... Well, yeah, it doesn't perplex me, Philip, because I think there's a lot of embarrassment involved in this, because it was quite clear, because I would imagine Fox paid a pretty penny for this to show it on TV in the States when it was first shown over there. Yep. And I would imagine it was shown in numerous countries around the world, and as far as I'm aware, they had individual contracts, did they not, for each territory?
Yes.
Do you think that people just, when it suddenly began to dawn on people that this just didn't seem right, that there were a lot of very embarrassed people who just wanted to forget about it?
Well, don't I feel embarrassed? I mean, you have to realise that whoever, you know, licensed the film from Santilli made a lot of money out of it.
Yeah, probably with advertising on through the shows, I would imagine.
As simple as that, you know, they made their own money out of it, so what?
Mm.
And, you know, it hadn't embarrassed them. They weren't involved in any court case, unlike the Hitler Diaries some years before, of course, ended up in court and a man went to prison.
Mm.
Nothing like that happened. There was no embarrassment as far as that was concerned. I mean, like I said, you know, the Fox video, when they released that, for example, sold in its hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. I've still got one. Strangely enough, a couple of years ago, Philip, I got somebody said, oh, I found all these old UFO magazines in a garage. He just said, oh, if you pay me postage and packaging, you can have them. So I said, yeah, no problem. And lo and behold, what was in them?
It was a
VHS. Copy of the Roswell auto. I mean, it's one of those strange things because obviously this was a couple of years ago before I did the show.
Yeah, I spoke with an Oscar-winning filmmaker. I'm not going to mention his name. And I told him I'd got a revised edition of a new book out that I was talking. And he said, what's it about? I said, it's the Roswell alien autopsy.
Mm.
And he says, you're joking. I says, no, why? He says, I actually started my career 25 years ago working on the alien autopsy, the production, you know, that he was one of those that was involved in the production of it, only in a small scale, but that he was his first run on the ladder, and he's gone on to be an award-winning Oscar-winning filmmaker. And he says, is it 25 years, Philip? I said, yeah, absolutely, 25 years. And he was astonished. Unfortunately, I didn't manage to get him to buy the film rights or anything. But, you know, I certainly tried, I can assure you. But, you know, he was absolutely dumbfounded. So here you have an Oscar-winning filmmaker whose first foot on the ladder was working on the alien autopsy film.
Hey, dear.
And who would have thought that in a thousand years?
This is what surprised me about this. If there was one thing I didn't think would resurface, Philip, it was this bloody thing.
Yeah.
I thought the Anton Deck film was the end of it. But no, 13 years after that, 2019, it suddenly starts to bubble up again. Were you surprised and thought, oh, my God, here we go again?
No, nothing surprises me. I mean, because it crops up in the most unlikely of places. again, I'll give you an example. A couple of years back in Blackpool, a chap called David, he'd run a UFO museum there for years. He'd moved the location, but it had been there for years, and he finally closed it. He got in touch with me, and So I went over to see him, and it was just, if everybody knows Blackpool, where the South Pier is, it was just a couple of streets back from the South Pier on the main street. I went, because I collect UFO memorabilia, and I went with my checkbook in the hope of buying some stuff from David. And I bought a couple of little things, but he was still hanging on. He was, you know, he was hanging up his Adamski scout ship, you know, he'd had enough.
Yeah.
But he still hoped to sell the business as a whole. And I said, well, I've only come to buy individual bits and pieces. And lo and behold, what's he got as a display? The alien autopsy. And he's even got, he even had a model of the alien standing up in a spacesuit. You know, so you got it lying on the slab with a couple of surgeons standing around, and then there was another one with it, what it might look like if it was still alive. I think that was the idea. And I tried to buy it off him, and I'll buy it. My wife just looked at me, you know, and thinking, where the hell are we going to put that, you know? but he didn't. I bought a couple of small things from him. Sadly, a couple of weeks later, David took seriously ill. He had a stroke. And has now since passed away. So where everything went, I don't know. I contacted his partner, and she said it had all gone. But then, of course, last year, I got a couple of emails. A chap said, have a look at this. And it was an 11-page document, which was an email thread going back to, was it 2000, 2001? That was addressed to US billionaire Bob Bigelow. But the main chap in it was a chap called Dr. Christopher Kit Green. And he was being asked by Dr. Eric Davis to clarify a number of things, all relating to the alien autopsy film. Now, at this point in time, going back to that time, Bigelow run his own organization called the National Institute for Discovery Sciences, NIDS.
Yes.
And these people were all part of NIDS. They were all on his payroll. So Dr. Eric Davis is quizzing Dr. Kit Green to clarify some of his previous statements, one of which was that in 1987/88, Kit Green, for those that are not aware, he used to work for the CIA at one point. He is a medical doctor, still has a practice today, and PhD as well. He said that he'd been invited to a briefing at the Pentagon and was shown a film that was, in capital letters, the same as the alien autopsy film. He then went on to give his own medical opinion on what the alien autopsy film that we all know about, what it depicts. And he even says at the end of it, you know, I spoke to some of Ray Santilli's PR folks, and they weren't very bright and they weren't very nice. But in the middle of all this, my name crops up. I'd been contacted about that point and put them in touch with Ray Santilli. So even my name is in the middle of all this. And of course, you know, it reopened the debate again. There were those that were claiming the CIA, they faked it.
Yeah.
And that it was written. Some say, no, it's real, because Dr. Kit Green is giving his medical opinion about it. Even though he sees some faults with the medical procedure, he has an excuse and a reason why that is. Kit Green was interviewed by American researcher Richard Dolan.
Yep.
And I contacted one of the gentlemen on this email list, and off the record, I said, is this email list, is it authentic? He says, yeah. I said, well, you all on it, everybody on it believe this is 5-6 years after the alien autopsy was released. You believe it was real? He said, oh, we don't believe that now. So, Kit Green went on to say that all the CIA lied to me. They showed me a fake film, but only parts of which were the same as the alien autopsy. So whether it was the whole film or parts of it, they can't have been the same as the alien autopsy film, because it wasn't thought about and designed and made until 1995. So there's something not right. Anyway, I got in touch with Kit Green, and he said, you know, I found him difficult to deal with. He should have been a politician, not a doctor, because he'd say things without telling you anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He did go on to say that, you know, he'd received about a dozen autopsy films down the years. But I got a quote out of him in the end. And in the early days of the research into the alien autopsy film, a lot of things were done in paper format, Paul.
Yeah.
So I decided to, now there was renewed interest, plus there was the 25th anniversary, was to do a revised edition of my earlier book. It's called Roswell Alien Autopsy, revised edition. 2020, and I published it in large format. And what I did, I took things out of my files here, and so you can see them all in full. So there's all the different letters from Kodak and faxes and photographs and letters and like full transcripts of interviews where in the past I'd only summarized them. Here's the whole transcript that I have, you know. So I put it all in there. It's a huge, great tome. So the book starts right at the very beginning, how it all started. As I've told you, we were shown a number of films, but we weren't the only one.
Yeah.
My wife Sue and I were shown all these films. A colleague by the name of Maurizio Baiata from Italy was shown them all. Colin Andrews, who's famous for his crop circle research, was shown them. The late Reg Presley.
Yes.
who was a friend of Ray's. He was shown them. I have a letters, you know, from Reg in the book. I met Reg many times and spoke to him on the phone about the alien autopsy and other stuff. So all this is in the book, so you can see it all for yourself. I still allow people to make their own mind up at the end of the day, but I don't leave you in any doubt that the film is 100% fake. It was made by Spiros Millaris. As we pointed out, I'd done a small piece for a production company in London. So I told them about what I was doing. So I sent them a copy of the book on PDF, and they said, you know, we can make a documentary about this, Philip. So they came here and filmed for a couple of days, and then I went to London and filmed in their studios in London. By the time we'd finished, we had enough material because they'd acquired some archive material as well. They'd also managed to get Ray Santilli to go on camera, which is unusual.
Yes.
And so we ended up with a four-part documentary series. It's called Alien Autopsy, The Search for Answers. So it's a retrospective title, and it's basically my story as we've been discussing tonight, Paul, and as is featured in my book, Roswell Alien Autopsy. It's out now. It's on Amazon Prime and Apple iTunes and maybe other places as well. I think it's got some good comments, some good thumbs up, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that's always struck me about yourself, Philip, is your diligent work in your research and your strength in regards to keeping audit trails. Because I know we were joking the other day in a little post you put up on Facebook in regards to an episode of The X-Files and a certain other case, which is something that's always interesting because I'm a massive X-Files fan. I'm quite weird like that I remember when certain things suddenly appear in certain conversations and all of a sudden something else changes in that particular conversation or that version of events, and I always found it very odd that a certain version of a certain story changed after that particular episode of The X-Files was broadcast. And at that time, and I think people forget this looking back, The X-Files was enormous.
Absolutely. The alien autopsy film, in reality, Paul, couldn't have come out at a better time.
It was absolutely. I mean, for you, obviously, you were knee deep into ufology at that time, Philip. Had you noticed that explosion in the sort of early to mid-90s that everybody had suddenly got into it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've had this discussion before with people and they're saying, oh, you know, it's the X-Files, it's, you know, it's not accurate. I said, it brings the paranormal into zillions of people's homes every night in a quite a positive manner as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
You know, what more could you ask for? You know, no documentary could do that.
Yeah,
you know, but this TV series did. So since then, you know, it that's got a life of its own. There's X-Files of everything, you know, and I was a big fan, still am.
Yeah,
that's why I've been watching. You know, I started again watching it from day one.
Yes,
and you know, they even did an episode on the alien autopsy.
Yes, they did.
And Fox Mulder, said, Scully asked him, do you think the one on Fox is real? He says, no. She says, why? He says, because they showed too much. You know? It was the alien autopsy film made it onto Seinfeld, the Simpsons, a whole host of other stuff. And it crops up in the most unlikely of places. You could, I think last year, you could still buy alien autopsy cakes in America for Halloween. Yes. Which when you cut it open, the goo runs out, and of course, that's jam.
Yeah.
You know, so it is firmly embedded now in popular culture. And when you talk about changing stories, of course, Ray Santilli changed his story in 2006 to coincide with the release of the movie.
Yep.
What he said had happened now, he said, well, in actual fact, what you see is a restoration. He said, I there was a gap between me meeting the cameraman and actually getting the film from him. And then during that time, when we got the film, it had deteriorated. And we only had a few frames left.
Mm.
So he says, I hired people and we actually did a restoration, he called it.
Yep.
And he said, it's a bit like The Last Supper, the painting of The Last Supper. It's had so many touch-ups, there's not much of the original left.
Mm.
But I said, hang on a minute, Ray. There's actually two alien autopsy films. You've got another one that's not been shown on television. So if I was an art restorer and they wanted me to restore some damage that had been done to the Mona Lisa, would I make another one that's different? No, you wouldn't. So why would you, if you were doing a restoration, why would you have two different autopsy films? Same room, same creature, same people, but different.
Yeah.
You know, one creature is fully intact, the other one isn't. And they do a different medical procedure. And he's hummed and hard about that now. He in the interview he did for our series, he says, showing Philip two different films, I don't remember that. You know, well, he didn't just show me. And that's why I have in my book, he showed them to Maurizio, to Colin Andrews, to Reg Presley. And I have statements from all of those people. Not me just making it up. I have statements from them.
So
he's and then, of course, people forget that Ray had a business partner at the time, was called Gary Shewfield.
Mm.
Gary did an interview with two people. I've no idea who they were. The end of last year. And, of course, he tells an entirely different story to what Ray does.
Mm.
You know, and he admits that, oh, yeah, we hired Spiros, you know, and we hired John Humphreys, but, oh, it really was. And he doesn't call it a restoration. He calls it a recreation.
Mm.
But he said we got about a minute and a half of film. That's all we could retrieve that was of any good. Mm. Now, 16 millimeter film runs at 24 frames per second. Mm. So even if you have just 1.5 minutes of film, it's 90 times 24.
Yeah.
That's still a lot of film.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't do it any harm to cut a couple of lumps of it off to send to Kodak.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know, even those two cannot get their stories right. And in this interview that Gary Shewfield did, he admits that the cameraman's interview that has only ever been shown on TV in Japan is a fake.
Yeah.
He says it was a down and out. We got off the streets of LA and filmed it.
Yeah.
So it's a crazy story. It really is. And something else will happen. Of course, when that email list came out last year, it was then dumped online.
Yeah.
I got one day's warning of it, which was no time to do anything.
Mm.
Santilli came out of his bunker and said, I knew there were documents that show it was real. He now claims that this email list was an internal memo from the CIA. Well, of course, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. You know, I fully suspect one of them, Shewfield or even Ray, might pop up somewhere.
Mm.
You know, to commemorate. I emailed them all recently and said, look, you know, I'm quite prepared to give you an open interview because the people who are interviewing them, with no disrespect to them, don't really know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them for that. He's not their fault.
Mm.
So you know, you have the wrong people asking the wrong questions. That's why they won't allow me to interview them because I know what to ask. So, you know, what have we got, a couple of weeks before the anniversary on the 28th of August?
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows what might happen?
Well, I mean, it was funny because I know we were talking about this a couple of months ago, and I just, you know, like you're saying, you've just started rewatching the X-Files from the beginning. There's a wonderful YouTube channel that has every episode of Sightings on there, and I know we had a bit of a laugh about something, which we might touch on. But I remember very negative about the whole thing.
And,
they interviewed Santilli on that, and in that interview he claimed that he'd got film with Eisenhower in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which a lot of people don't seem to remember him discussing now, and that's there. That can't be disputed. It's on film.
It wasn't Eisenhower, it was Truman.
Truman, sorry, yes. You know, when I was talking to you about it online, Philip, I was really surprised looking back how negatively they viewed the whole film and Santilli himself. They just, you know, we're talking about a series that did promote some pretty far out
for those that know, where the Sightings TV show was great, you know, and I loved it. Their stance was that if this film is real, Santilli cannot own it because it's US military film, so they're not going to pay him for it.
Yeah.
You know, and he wanted paying for it, so they took the stance they did. What is interesting, you know, Santilli was asked at one point, what convinced you that the film was real, that it was authentic? He says, when you see President Truman on it.
Yeah.
Because he said, you see him so clearly, you can read his lips. Right?
Yeah.
Of course, Truman's nowhere to be found. The late Stanton Friedman checked Truman's whereabouts on the dates these things were supposed to be happening. He was nowhere near this area, you know. So, yes, he said, Truman. So, Sightings were actually at the conference in Sheffield.
Yeah.
And they were in the audience like everybody else. And when Santilli put his tape down and it disappeared, he was going to blame the Sightings people for nicking it. Because as far as they were concerned, he couldn't own the rights to it if it was real.
Yeah.
Because it was US military footage.
Yeah.
Therefore, it belonged to the US public, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But of course they didn't nick it. It was someone else. But you know, but what was funny, Sightings in one of their episodes were discussing the alien autopsy film, and they went on to say that all military medical films of that time were shot in color.
Mm.
And then they went and showed one, and bugger me, it was in black and white. So
fabulous.
I contacted the National Archives in the US and asked them that very question, and asked them if they had any examples. And they sent me a list of medical US military films that were medical procedures, and they were all in black and white.
Mm.
But Santilli was lucky in a lot of ways, because one of the arguments was, of course, that if this was real footage, that the American authorities, whoever they may be, would never let it out of the country. You know, you never see it.
Mm.
And about the same time, a chap here in the UK went to a car boot sale, and he bought some VHS video cassettes for next to nothing.
Mm.
They wanted to record things at home, and he thought, just out of curiosity, I'll stick one in my player and see what's on them.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, these were secret military training films of the SAS that was bought on a car boot sale.
Oh, it's amazing. Sometimes stuff. I was watching TV the other day, and I ended up catching a bit of Antiques Roadshow, Philip.
Mm.
And there was a guy on there who worked at a dump in London, and he'd come on with a massive box of items that had all been written by Churchill's cook.
Yep.
And somebody just chucked them all out, and there was like his cigars, top hat, signed letters, Christmas cards, and somebody just boxed them all up and chucked them away.
Well, it's funny you should mention Churchill, because he fits into this story as well, believe it or not.
Now,
because, again, around about the same time, in somebody's attic somewhere, was a film of Churchill visiting America during the war.
Mm.
And I think it was filmed at the top of the Empire State Building or some such thing.
Mm.
And it was so clear. It looked like it had been shot yesterday. And, of course, Ray Santilli's film is clear. You know, it's relatively clear. So people arguing that film wouldn't keep all those years were talking nonsense, because here we've got a piece of film of Churchill from during the war. Mm. And if it's stored correctly, as this had been, then there's no reason why it shouldn't be, you know, be viewable. Mm. So he got lucky in a couple of items as well, you know. Mm. But yeah, so even Churchill plays a part in the Alien Autopsy film, believe it or not, you know. Mm. And where it'll crop up next, Paul, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, yeah, all bets are off now, Philip. I've learnt to keep my counsel now. I'm not going to put that one to bed. I'm expecting it to reappear when I'm in my dotage, I no doubt.
Well, when Spiros first stepped forward, we'd actually got Spiros's first name, and he stepped forward, and he contacted a colleague of mine first, Russell Callahan. Mm. Russ run a little magazine called UFO Data, and Russ said, "It's not me you need to speak to, it's Philip." And as soon as I spoke to him, my name's Spiros Malaris, and he just filled in all the gaps straight away. Mm. So when I met Spiros and we were chatting away, and I said, you know, obviously I didn't know him, you know, we weren't friends or anything. I said, you know, this film will never die. It'll never go away. And he thought, what are you talking about? And now he admits I'm right. Mm. Because it won't go away. There are people who still believe that it is authentic. Mm. There are those that say that Spiros is a disinformation agent.
Yes.
he's not. I've been in his house. You know, I've met his partner, ex-partner, as they were now, and her daughter. I've met some of his friends. He's a very talented artist in his own right.
Yeah.
He's a magician. I've seen some of his magic in person, not just on television. I've seen him do it.
Yeah.
And he won't tell me how he did it, like none of the magicians will. Mm. You know, he is a member of the magic circle, and he's a businessman to boot. See, what would have happened with Spiros when he told me on the telephone, I did this, we did that, we did this, we did that. Great. It filled in all the gaps, but now you have to prove it. So I went with my wife and stayed at his house, and he got boxes out. He got his diaries out from the time, you know, meeting with Santa Leon, such and such. He even hand painted a storyboard.
Yes. Yes, he did.
And the storyboard must be about, I don't know, 20 paintings, you know, of a fair size. So they weren't quickly done. And he had some of his own paintings of other things on, you know, on his wall. In his house, for example, this is where the Truman bit comes in. He got a box out. And in this box was a file, all of American military vehicles. And I said, what do you want all these? And they were just pictures on, pictures and pictures. And he said, I was going to use that one. He says, what I wanted to do was to build a crash flying saucer. And so you'd have the saucer impacted into the desert. And I was going to use a military truck. It was going to, you know, either make one or disguise an ordinary truck to make it look like, you know, and I was going to put that number plate on it. So if you checked in the records,
you'd find it.
You'd find it. And he says, I was going to get an actor. I think an actor was might have been one of his friends or his family. And we're going to do prosthetics on him to make him look like President Truman. And we'd tell him what to say. Obviously, you don't have a soundtrack on it, but we would make sure that you could, quoting Santilli, read his lips.
Yes.
And he said, I even got a location to do this. It was an abandoned go-kart stadium. And he said, the only reason we didn't do it is because we'd run out of time and money. Mm. The only reason they were going to do that is because Santilli had said Truman was on the film. Mm. And of course, there was no film, you know, until Spiros made it, apart from the tent footage. So he was even going to do President Truman, you know, and he's still got boxes of stuff. He has tape recorded telephone conversations with the individuals involved. Mm. These weren't secret, you know. He said, "Can I take this?" Yeah. And that, you know, they're admitting to it being I've listened to some of them. He has been trying to write a book for quite some years, but he'd be the first to admit he's not a writer.
Yeah.
I know he's written some of it because I've read it.
Yeah.
He sent it to me and I have read it. I'm hoping he'll get it finished this year. But Spiros is the man, you know, behind it. I have no doubt in that whatsoever. And of course, in the interview that Gary Shewfield did at the end of last year, He says, we hired Spiros.
Yeah.
He filmed it, hired the props, and we hired John Humphreys. He was our special effects guy. So there you go. But there's more to come. I mean, I think Spiros' story and the story of my lot of years of research would make a great film. You know,
absolutely.
Me trying to find him. Believe it or not, Spiros was actually in my house back in 1995 because Santilli made his own film, and they even did a follow-on film that never made it onto television, and Spiros was the man that did the filming, and he came to my house and interviewed me. And I had no idea. He didn't tell me his name.
Yeah.
You know, at that point in time, Paul, I had numerous TV crews at my house from different parts of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and Spiros laughed. I says, you rotten bugger. You know how many years I spent looking for you when you were in my house?
You know. Oh, it's just another tangled web in this incredible story that just seems to just keep coming back every time we think it's gone.
Well, there will be more twists of that, I'm sure, Paul. Oh, wow. I just don't know what they'll be. But yes, and so, you know, the Alien Autopsy film is firmly rooted in popular culture soil. You can even buy on, I think it's Etsy,
yep,
your own knitting pattern to knit your own Alien Autopsy. I kid you not.
No, nothing surprises me. There's some very weird and wonderful things on Etsy, yeah. Oh, so, Philip, obviously, before I let you go, because thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to listen to this whole crazy story and your involvement in it. Your publishing company, what have you got lined up and what's currently available?
Well, we got books and publications from around the world, Paul. You know, just go to flyingdispress.com. That's disc with a K. They're all there. You know, a wide variety of books. You know, we have Tiago Tichetti from Brazil. We have Roberto Pinotti's books from Italy. Dr. Dan Farkas from Romania. Peter Cielebias from Poland. We have Calvin Parker, the Pascagoula case.
Yep.
Three books on that. No, in fact, four. Because we have a book by a Greek colleague by the name of Stephanos Panagiotakis.
Yep.
How long I've tried to practice saying these names, you know. And of course, there's my own works out now as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a wide variety of public. I started Flying Disc Press in 2015. It's just me that runs it, you know, and I do my damnedest to make different material that's not perhaps readily available in the mainstream, you know, from different countries, different authors, as well as my own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had one bestseller, which was Calvin Parker's first book,
yep,
which is Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter. A fascinating read, and his follow-up book, Pascagoula, The Story Continues, is equally as fascinating. You won't regret it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all there, you know. And my latest two books, Without Consent and Roswell Alien Autopsy, they're all on there. You just, it's pictures of them, you just click on it, and it takes you to the link on Amazon. And I hope you find something that you like.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I'll put some links in the show notes so everybody can track them down and get them. And I recommend several of them, as I own several of them, Philip.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Are you still doing the Outer Limits podcast?
Yes, my colleague Chris Evers and I do a fortnightly podcast. We're taking a little break just for a few weeks because I got the book out Without Consent now. So, you know, rather than doing my own podcast, I'm talking to people like yourself. I'm going to London later this month to film another documentary. Again, the next book I'm going to publish after my own, Paul, is rather different. It comes out on September the 1st, and it's by a US researcher called John Steiger, and it's called the UFO Trilogy, Dramas for the Stage. So it's actually three stage plays, and they're all based on real-life accounts. One is based on Roswell,
yeah.
One is based on Rendlesham, and one is based on the Linda Cortile Brooklyn Bridge abduction.
Yes.
But they're all fictional scenarios based on real accounts. So, you know, something completely different.
Mm.
And then on November the 1st, I've worked with a chap by the name of Ronald Kinsella, who's an author and illustrator, and I've written a book called Introducing UFOs, A Young Person's Guide. So it's for more of a teenage audience, and that's an introductory book, and it's been largely illustrated by Ronald Kinsella. So that'll be out November the 1st, and then we move into the new year, and we have a whole raft of books, you know, up and coming.
Fantastic.
So it's going to be a busy old time.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Right. One more thing before I let you go then, Philip, if that's all right. So we've talked about a couple of classic cases and things like that. Is there any case that you've been made aware of over the last sort of 5 years that perhaps we're not aware of? Or because I think often ufology, to the outsider, Philip, a lot of it tends to be classic cases. You know, people still talk about Betty and Barney Hill. They still talk about the Cash Landrum case.
Yeah.
Obviously, Calvin's encounter in the 70s, Allen and Rendlesham in 1980, Phoenix Lights in 1997. Is there anything that you think in the last sort of five to 10 years that people really need to can get involved in and discover?
Yeah, I mean, what I've done with Without Consent, and it's one of the reasons why I did it, is because we had some new information. The two cases, they're not individual cases. The two people that we feature in it, they've had, rather than have a one-off encounter, they've had a almost like a lifetime of events. So, believe it or not, The very last case in the revised edition of Without Consent is from a local lady here in Pontefract. And I haven't used her real name, but I do have it. But she has had, I think she calls it a 30 years of experiences. So obviously we can't put them all in depth, but we've done our best to sort of go through the salient points of it. And then the one case before that is a chap called David Rogers. David's from the Midlands. And David's the same. You know, he's had UFO sightings and encounters for the biggest part of 20 years. So we've put that in there as well. And so they bring things. What you're kind of seeing Without Consent, Paul, is you see the evolution of the sort of contact experience. Because some of the accounts we have in there go back to the 1940s.
Yeah.
And then we've got it right the way through to today's 21st century.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how things have changed. You know, what that says about the phenomena, I'll leave others to decide. So you actually see the evolution of these encounters as well. Whereas if you were just reading one book, not that you shouldn't, but if you're reading, say, one book about Betty and Barney Hill, you wouldn't be able to see any of that.
Yes.
Because we often look at cases in isolation.
Yeah.
Whereas this book looks at encounters across, you know, the decades. And you can see how things change. I won't tell you how they change. How they change, you've got to find out to buy the book, you know. but you can see the evolution of the contact experience. I think that's the best way to see it. And I bring it right up to date. And I do put some classic cases in there that people have never heard of. I guarantee it, you know, if they were out in the public domain, you know, these would be classic cases. But there's other case histories that have gone in there that I haven't really published before. A lot of photographs, illustrations. For example, the Robert Taylor incident
in
Livingston, Scotland.
Yep.
Robert actually had missing time. So we have one chapter in Without Consent called The Nearly Files. Basically, these are cases of missing time. Now, Robert's encounter, I met Robert. I went and interviewed him in person. His encounter is the only one that has ever had an official police investigation. And, of course, that's all in writing. So I've put the full police report in there. So you can actually read the police forensic report, you know, the detective that spoke to him, etc. You don't have to take my word for it. It's all there.
Absolutely. I've always found that a fascinating case. And you know, he seemed a very, I don't mean this disrespectfully, a very simple man, a very normal person, wasn't he, Philip? No interest in the subject, you know. He probably didn't know anything about UFOs. And once again,
Here's the story for that for you. I mean, I went to interview him with Malcolm Robinson after he'd retired. So he wasn't living in Livingston. He was living in a place called Blairgowrie. So I went with Malcolm to Decamont Woods, where the incident happens. Bearing in mind, Malcolm hadn't been there for a long time. and the area had changed somewhat. So we found it. And in the clearing where Robert Taylor had his encounter then, I don't know if it's still there now, but there was a picnic bench and seats concreted into the ground. So I said to Malcolm, why don't you get a little brass plaque made with Livingston Encounter and just screw it onto the edge of this picnic bench. Mm. Malcolm took it one step further and contacted the local council. Yeah. And they ended up putting a memorial stone there with a big plaque on it.
Yeah.
now they've even got signage telling you where to go. But that all came from an off-the-cuff remark. Mm. But the funny thing was, we're wandering around this forest, Decmont Woods. Right next to it is a golf course. So there were some young kids. I think they were collecting, you know, sort of lost golf balls.
Yeah, as you do.
So Malcolm said to him, excuse me, lads, do you know where the UFO place was? And they said, yeah. He said, if I give you 50p, will you show me? I said, Malcolm, do you realise what you're saying? You're enticing children with money into the woods, you know. And we've had many a laugh about that, you know what I mean?
Oh, dear me. Malcolm gets himself in some situations sometimes.
Yeah, you. And it was just funny, you know. But luckily, he remembered where it was. He saw a particular landmark. And actually, it had grown, you know. They hadn't been there for years and years. And the trees had grown and so on. Mm. You know, with just funny little things that happened.
Fabulous. Well, listen, Philip, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you and listen to some of the strange and wonderful experiences you've been involved in over the years. So thank you for your time. And like I say, long overdue, and you're always welcome to come back whenever you wish, sir.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.